From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Labor is going international, both across borders and inside borders. It is one of the ironies of neoliberal globalization that it has produced all these bridges for labor to also go global.
In this age of globalization, it's important for us to remember that the issue of migration has to also be seen in the context of economic terrorism.
Today, a Labor Day special. We'll also go to Oakland, where dock workers have declared a breakdown in talks, and the Bush administration has threatened to bring in the troops, saying a strike would be unpatriotic. Then we'll look at a job to die for, why so many Americans are killed, injured, or made ill at work, and what to do about it. And unjust rewards, how the government continues to award federal business worth billions to companies that repeatedly break the law by injuring workers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from South Africa. Some 20,000 people march from the poverty-stricken Alexandria township to the gleaming buildings of the plush convention center where delegates from around the world are meeting for the UN Earth Summit in Johannesburg. The people called for jobs, land, water, electricity, and homes for the poor, an end to privatization, and the dismantling of the World Bank. More than half the people of Alexandria are unemployed. Police and armored trucks trained their machine guns on the crowd and helicopters circled overhead. At a separate pro-government rally that drew just 3,000 people, South African President Thabo Mbeki called for an end to the global apartheid, dividing a few rich from the legions of the world's poor. Today, South African President Mbeki opened the final phase of the World Summit by urging leaders to take firm action on poverty and the environment. He asked, "Since the means exist to banish hunger, why are so many without adequate supplies of food and others are faced with famine, including millions in this region of southern Africa? Why do millions die every year from avoidable and curable diseases when sciences, technology, and engineering have the means to save these human lives? Why do we have wars when we established institutions to end war?" Those were the words, again, of the South African president. Ministers and officials talked well into Sunday night in an attempt to finalize the summit's official plan of action. One of the remaining stumbling blocks was resolved when the U.S. finally agreed to accept a commitment to halve the 2 billion people living without sanitation by the year 2015. The London Independent is reporting after an impassioned plea from Ethiopia, ministers last night rejected U.S.-backed clauses in the summit's plan of action, which would have given the World Trade Organization powers over international treaties on the environment. Under the clauses, the WTO would have been able to override the Cartagena Protocol on biosafety, which gives developing countries the right to refuse to take genetically modified imports. The clause would also have placed at risk international treaties controlling the trade in toxic waste, chemicals that destroy the ozone layer, and the pollution that causes global warming. Originally, the only resistance to the proposals came from Norway and Switzerland, but after the Ethiopian delegation made its intervention, the rest of the developing world swung against it, followed by the European Union. One British negotiator said early this morning, "I've never seen so many environmental ministers hugging each other as when the proposal went down." The breakthrough rocked the U.S. delegation, which has been blocking progress on most issues at the summit. Meanwhile, the London Guardian's reporting a global deal on renewable energy is almost certain to be adopted in the next 24 hours. But stiff opposition from the U.S. and some oil-producing countries had last night all but ruined a Brazilian plan to boost the proportion of solar, wind, and other renewable energies to a mere 10% by 2010. Instead, it appears the summit will adopt a European Union proposal to raise the proportion of renewable energies by 1% over the next decade. Rich countries led by the U.S. have also succeeded in blocking demands by some poor countries that there should be more corporate accountability. Many European human rights groups say they are appalled at how the talks have suffocated moves to improve the lives of the majority of poor people. Secretary of State General Colin Powell has broken his silence on the issue of a possible attack on Iraq. Powell told the BBC that UN weapons inspectors must return to Iraq and the world must be given evidence of the threat posed by Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein before any action is taken. The BBC released only a small portion of Powell's interview to promote the full broadcast next week. Powell's words directly contradicted a speech Vice President Dick Cheney gave last week. Cheney said the time for inspections is over and that a preemptive strike is the only solution. Meanwhile, Time magazine is reporting Powell is planning to leave his job as Secretary of State at the end of the president's first term in 2004, potentially threatening Bush's reelection chances by robbing him of a moderate ally. Meanwhile, close to 100 protesters rallied outside Senator John Kerry's office in downtown Boston Friday while members of an anti-war group met with senators' policy aides. And former President Bill Clinton has finally commented publicly on the issue. He said Friday a U.S. attack on Iraq could give Saddam Hussein an excuse to use weapons of mass destruction against the United States and its allies. He said the current administration should move cautiously on Iraq and urge President Bush to listen to Congress and the public. Israeli troops shot and killed four Palestinian laborers near Hebron early today. For the third time in 4 days that Israeli troops have killed groups of unarmed Palestinian civilians, 14 Palestinians have been killed. On Thursday, troops shelled a home in the Gaza Strip, killing four members of a family. A helicopter gunship fired missiles at a car in the West Bank town of Tubas on Saturday, killing a wanted man along with four children. According to the London Guardian, the spate of killings by the Israeli army during a relative lull in suicide bombings has brought unprecedented levels of criticism from the Israeli press. The Israeli Defense Ministry says it has launched an investigation into the incidents. Palestinian officials are slamming Washington for its silence in the face of the killings. Walmart executives said it was a mistake to mail a company publication featuring Republican Senate candidate Elizabeth Dole on the cover less than 2 weeks before the Republican primary in North Carolina. The publication, sent to nearly 200,000 North Carolina residents, was meant to promote literacy, not Dole's candidacy, they say. The senior vice president of Walmart said there was nothing remotely political in the intent. Allen said the Bentonville, Arkansas company would send a letter to the Federal Election Commission informing it of the mailing to make sure no campaign laws were violated. Dole's rivals said the mailing was a blatant attempt by the nation's largest retail chain to influence North Carolina's primary.
Joe Hill came over from Sweden shore, looking for some work to do. And the Statue of Liberty waved him by as Joe came sailing through. Joe Hill, as Joe came sailing through. Oh, his clothes were coarse and his hopes were high as he headed for the promised land. And it took a few weeks on the out-of-work streets before he began to understand. Then he got hired by Bowery Bar, sweeping up in a saloon. As his rag would sail over the barroom rail, it sounded like he whistled on a tune. You could almost hear him whistling on a tune. And Joe rolled on from job to job, the docks to the railroad line. Age. He had nothing to show but his age. So he headed out to the California shore. But there things were just as bad.
Joe Hill, Billy Bragg, here on Democracy Now! On this Labor Day, I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiations over the West Coast dock workers' contract broke down over the weekend. This means that over 10,000 members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union may begin work slowdowns as early as tomorrow at some 30 major West Coast ports that handle the booming Pacific Rim trade. Reading from an article in Labor Notes called Bush Threatens West Coast Dockers' Right to Strike, David Bacon and Frieda Kuden write, "The confrontation on the West Coast docks could become the defining union conflict of the Bush administration. The traditional issues of union bargaining have been preempted by a much more basic one. Do dock workers have the right to strike at all?" If this slowdown happens tomorrow, the shipping lines say they will lock out the dock workers. The LA Times recently reported the Bush administration has threatened to bring in troops to quell any strike. The ports, which would be affected, handle more than $300 billion in trade annually. In a recent report for the Interpress Service, the labor journalist David Bacon writes, "The traditional bargaining issues, wages, benefits, and working conditions have been preempted by a much more basic one. Do dock workers have the right to strike at all?" Bacon continues, "Union leaders fear signs that President George Bush will attempt to benefit from his ongoing war on terror to label any future strike by the workers a threat to national security." We go now to Jack Heyman, officer of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in Oakland. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jack Heyman.
Thank you, Amy.
So the latest news, dock workers declaring a breakdown in talks and the Bush administration threatening to bring in the troops if you strike. What is your response?
Well, I think it definitely is a defining moment in the labor movement. Almost 20 years ago, it was the air traffic controllers that led a strike, and that, in a negative sense, was a defining moment in the labor movement, and I think set labor back for many, many years. We're at a watershed right now where if we do decide to strike, and if the rank and file decides to take whatever action it does, that the AFL-CIO is committed to backing the ILWU because they don't want to see another PATCO, air traffic controllers disaster, happen. And we'll just have to wait and see what happens in the coming days.
Hmm. What about this issue of the Bush administration talking about the strike as unpatriotic, saying it's a threat to national security, and talking about bringing these troops in?
Well, under the guise of national security, the Bush administration has attempted to lobby forces against the Longshore Union. They've made, through a lawyer for the Labor Department, very direct threats against the union, saying that if we were to wage any kind of a strike action, they would immediately send in the troops. I understand that Navy personnel are now deployed in the port of San Diego, waiting for any kind of action. Other threats by the Bush administration have been to invoke Taft-Hartley, which, by the way, in 78, the last time that was used against the miners was not very successful. Apparently the miners didn't understand what Jimmy Carter was attempting to do. But I think more ominously, the threat that the Bush administration poses, aside from sending in the troops, is a direct threat to break up the union. They are threatening to destroy the ILWU as it exists into port-by-port unions, which would eliminate the power of the union and eliminate the hiring hall from which our power derives. These are the major threats that are being posed, and this is why it's a wake-up call for the labor movement. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that unless the labor movement rallies behind the ILWU, if the troops come in, this could very well be the end of the trade union movement in this country as we know it.
You know, I don't know if this would have anything to do with it. But there's an interesting piece in the Washington Post today called Ports at Risk, Coast Guard on the Prowl, elite teams created to focus on threats after September 11th. And it talks about a new maritime SWAT team called the Coasties that has been established. Members of a branch of the nation's armed services, even though the agency is officially part of the Department of Transportation, the Bush administration has proposed folding the Coast Guard into the Department of Homeland Security. And it says, in tribute to September's victims, the six Marine safety and security teams are given designating numbers that begin with the infamous date. The first team, commissioned this summer, based in Seattle, is Unit 91101. The Virginia team is 91102. Two additional units will be commissioned this month in Los Angeles and Houston, and two more will be situated next year in New York and Jacksonville, Florida. The teams are to be based at some of the nation's most important and strategic ports. Los Angeles and New York are huge commercial ports. Seattle is near the porous Canadian border. The Virginia team is near the world's largest Navy port and U.S. Capitol. And it talks about what they'll be wearing, saying the uniforms are designed to lend an intimidating air of authority, much like riot police. They wear plain blue pants and shirts. They carry M16 rifles, wear bulletproof vests. Their life jackets have pockets designed to hold batons, guns, pepper spray, and handcuffs. When they go on a mission, they will strip all vestiges of rank from their collars, so each will appear to have equal authority. Do you have any concerns with these being posted at the ports and the dock workers, of course, being there as well, what that could mean?
Yes, of course we do. And I think that the role that the Coast Guard is playing, and the Bush administration in particular, is using this national security issue and the fear of terrorism for its own agenda. And this is nothing new by deploying the Coast Guard in such a fashion, because it's been done since the McCarthy period. Back in the 50s, it was the Coast Guard that did the screening against the union organizers and radicals that helped build the ILWU and other unions, and denied them right to employment on the ships and on the docks. The Coast Guard historically has been used not to fight terror, but to weed out militants in the labor movement. And I think, once again, this is a clear attempt to intimidate the trade union movement. I think it came across most clearly in the beginning of negotiations when Tom Ridge, the director of Homeland Security, made a chilling phone call to ILWU President Jim Spinoza, basically saying that it would not be in the national interest if the ILWU exercised its right to strike. He had no business making that phone call. And can you imagine, Amy, if J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, had called Harry Bridges back in the 40s or 50s? That would have been the shortest phone call in history. It would have hung up on him. Tom Ridge had no right to make that telephone call. It was an intimidating phone call. It was inappropriate. It was out of place. It should never have happened.
I'm wondering where the Teamsters stand on you, on the ILWU. The Bush, of course, in 2004, hoping to be endorsed by one or more major unions, particularly the Teamsters. He has tried to court the Teamsters, talking about the end of federal supervision of the Teamsters imposed 13 years ago because of the union's history of corruption and ties to the mafia. Where does Jimmy Hoffa stand on your labor struggle?
Well, we've had several rallies here on the West Coast ports, and James Hoffa and the Teamsters have been solidly behind us. James Hoffa spoke here in Oakland at our rally back in June, right before the contract expired. And he gave a full commitment from the Teamsters to the ILWU. If the Bush administration's attacks, by whichever means it decides to use, the Teamsters will be behind us solidly. And that's an important step because they are a key transport union in this country. The other support that we have that's critical is from the Longshore Union on the East Coast. We've made tremendous strides in building links to the Longshore Unions on the coast, on the ports on the East Coast, so that if the Bush administration attempts in any way to undermine our right to strike, that we are going to have the kind of support that the labor movement has not seen in decades. And that's why we're hoping that if this is the defining moment, it will be a very positive step for the labor movement to defend our right to strike. That something is vital to all unions in this country.
Jack Heyman, I want to thank you very much for being with us of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in Oakland, California. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at what's happening to airport workers around the country. As of November, no baggage screener or other categories of airport worker, certain other categories, will be allowed to be on the job who are not U.S. citizens. We'll speak with one of the star baggage screeners at San Francisco Airport. Her name is Erlinda Valencia. She won an award but could be thrown out because she's not a U.S. citizen. And then we're going to go around the world and look at immigrants. We'll be speaking with the author of Guests and Aliens, Saskia Sassen, and also find out what's happening with Indonesian workers in Malaysia who've been threatened with caning if these workers remain in Malaysia, and so tens of thousands of them are leaving. Stay with us.
Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right, but when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet, you will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky, way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. Holy rollers and jumpers come out, and they sing and they clap and they shout. Give your money to Jesus, they say. He will cure all diseases today.
The preacher and the slave. Haywire Mac McClintock here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the Los Angeles area, some 100 airport workers were arrested in government raids last weekend. Most of them were immigrants. Government officials said the workers had used false IDs and lied about their immigration status to obtain security clearance. Nationwide, some 350 airport workers have been arrested in similar sweeps since September 11th. The arrests come as part of Operation Tarmac, an initiative of the INS and Social Security Administration to review the immigration records of 200,000 workers at about 100 airports. Under the Aviation and Transportation Security Act, passed since 9/11, permanent residents of all nationalities who are currently employed as airport screeners will soon be summarily fired from their jobs and barred from reapplying as screeners, presumptively treated as security risks by virtue of their lawful non-citizenship status. The crackdown is affecting immigrant workers regardless of their skill, experience, and dedication. During a two-week stint in the year 2000, Erlinda Valencia spotted a loaded handgun and a disarmed novelty hand grenade in bags passing through the screening machine she operates in the domestic terminal at San Francisco International Airport. That month, she earned her security firm's top screener award. Despite her 14 years of experience, she could lose her position if she doesn't get citizenship before November. Erlinda Valencia joins us on the phone right now from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day, too.
Well, I don't know how happy it is for you considering what you face, but can you explain what you and other screeners face by November?
Well, this is a scary thing to think about because come November 19, the contract of our private company, or TSA, will end. And it was said by the TSA that we will be replaced by U.S. citizen screeners coming from the military, the ex-militaries, and those employees who were laid off from the airline. So it means that even though we have serve our company or the airport or the flying public for so many years, they disregard our experience and our skill. They would like to replace us with new ones, and it means that our national safety is at a risk because we're scared that the flying public will be will not be screened or will not be checked thoroughly because these new ones who will be replacing us are not as skilled as we are because they are in the process of learning the job that we have been doing long ago. So it is really unfair for us to be laid off for doing our job. And the only reason why we will be laid off is because we are not a U.S. citizen. And they said that even though you're a U.S. citizen, as long as you're a current screener, you don't have any assurance that you can keep the job. So the treatment to us incumbent screeners are very unjust because in spite of the loyalty we have shown them, still we are treated like terrorists.
Now, in the last few months, though, the San Francisco International Airport, the workers won a kind of reprieve, haven't you? A pilot 2-year program where you'll be one of 5 U.S. airports that will retain privately contracted security screeners. But are you saying that even if you have that, you will not be employed by them? They can keep the private companies, but you have to be a U.S. citizen to work for them?
Yeah, that's why we considered it a partial victory. We were able to get the retention of 2 years under pilot program, but the same procedure as that of the federal will be undertaken. So there's no use getting this pilot program if the same thing will happen to us.
So the companies won, like Argan Bright Security, though they've been banned from future government contracts. But the corporations won that have the private contracts, but the workers have lost.
Yeah. Those who are, they wanted an American-owned company to handle us. That's one criteria in choosing the company to take over. And the other thing that we consider a victory is that we can keep a union, but we still don't know if they can. They will accept the union that we have now. So it is really a question to us why we incumbent screeners will not be placed or will not keep their job and still be replaced by American citizens who came from the military and from the airline when we already have the pilot program.
Could you get citizenship by November?
Yeah, I will be interviewed by October, so I can get it soon.
How helpful is it to have people organizing on your behalf?
Well, they are very supportive to us. Our union is very supportive, and so with the Bay Area Organizing Committee.
Which is a group of religious congregations and unions working together,
yes,
advocating for screening.
Yes, they are very supportive. In fact, the San Mateo Labor Council conducted several training, helping us in our problem with the INS, give us English proficiency training, so that all those people like me will learn good English, will not have an accent, because they said that if you have an accent, although you can speak good English, still you will fail their test. So the same federal criteria.
You won Screener of the Month?
Not this month, but when I got those items,
yes.
I was the Screener of the Month.
And what does the airport say? here you were one of their top screeners.
Yeah, I was. Everybody appreciates what I'm doing, and they believe that I'm really good at it. So.
Well, Orlinda Valencia, I want to thank you for being with us. Screener from San Francisco Airport, again, fighting for her job. At this point, the only way she can keep it is by becoming a U.S. citizen. Screeners will be fired all over the country as of November if they are not U.S. citizens, despite the fact that they are lawfully in this country. We're going to go now from Orlinda Valencia abroad to another situation where immigrants face very serious resistance. And these are Indonesian workers in Malaysia. They have been expelled from Malaysia in a crackdown on immigrants and have been sent to remote border camps with little clean water and poor sanitary conditions and then sent on to Indonesia. It's Indonesian workers as well as Philippine workers. Protesters in the Philippines burned pictures of the Malaysian prime minister after reports that several Filipino children had died after being held in the overcrowded detention centers in Malaysia. Malaysia began enforcing tough new measures last month against migrant workers, including caning and hefty fines. Malaysia is one of Southeast Asia's most prosperous countries. More than 300,000 migrants from the Philippines and Indonesia have fled or been expelled. Filipino news sources are also reporting as many as 3,000 homes of Filipinos have been burned down. Malaysia temporarily has halted the controversial program over the weekend. Today, Philippine officials traveled to Malaysia to seek repatriation of the deportees. We're joined by Lilian Fan, who is with Amnesty International. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Lilian.
Thank you, Amy, for having me here. First of all, I want to clarify those numbers that you quoted are much, much lower than the actual situation. What we're actually seeing on the ground is that there have been, 1.7 million foreign workers who are in Malaysia. More than half of them are illegal, and at least double than the numbers you quoted are being sent back. The border camps are right now full of these undocumented workers, and these include families, little children who have been in the country for over 10 years, some of them. A lot of the children have been actually born in the country, but they're without any kind of birth certification.
Lilian, you're from Malaysia. You just came from Malaysia as well. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Well, these last few months, I've been working with Amnesty International, particularly on the issue of refugees in Malaysia. And through my work doing that, I was in a position to actually see what was happening, not just to refugees who are from neighboring conflict areas, but also to foreign workers who are undocumented, who were facing great risk because of this new amended law. Now, the law came into effect on August 1st. A few weeks before that, there were floods of asylum seekers, hundreds and hundreds of them who went to approach the UNHCR in Kuala Lumpur, demanding that they be allowed to seek asylum. Now, these people were from conflict areas in the region. They were from Aceh, which is experiencing a very long war between, separatist rebels and the Indonesian military. And the people who are really suffering at the hands of this are the ordinary civilians. And there's this entire civil movement there that has been crushed. Now, these are people who then flee to Malaysia and are not recognized as being political refugees, because we don't recognize that in Malaysia. They're seen as being economic migrants seeking better opportunity. The same goes for nationals of Burma or even ethnic nationalities who are not recognized as citizens in Burma and have no legal status in their countries. They flee to our country, but they're not recognized as being political refugees. Now, it's not only political refugees who are affected by these laws, of course. There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of economic migrants who have come, who have built our infrastructure, who have made Malaysia one of the most prosperous nations in Southeast Asia. We have the tallest buildings in the world. We have excellent infrastructure. And this is very much in thanks to the work that has been, the sacrifices that have been made by these workers. They're leaving their families, they're coming to our country to work, and they're coming from countries which have been impoverished and are still in poverty, in the worst poverty that the region has seen, actually, because of the effects of the Asian economic crisis of 1997. And the impacts of that crisis are still very, very real. You know, you can look at financial reports that say, well, there's been a recovery in economic terms. But if you look at what's actually happening on the ground, families have been devastated. I mean, entire communities have been absolutely made unviable, you know, socially, economically, and politically. So you're talking about the general situation in Southeast Asia right now, and that's the context in which you have this huge flow of migration.
And these workers have been threatened with caning if they don't leave immediately?
That's right. This amended law, illegal migrants are now faced with very, very heavy penalties. One of them includes up to 6 strokes of the cane. They're also faced with up to 10,000 ringgit, which is equivalent to about $2,500 US, in fines. Now, they also say that those who harbor these illegals will also be charged, but the track record is that it's actually the workers themselves who face these penalties much more than their employers do.
And these camps that the Indonesians and Filipino workers are being put into?
Right. You know, appalling as it is, this news of the maltreatment and the malnutrition and abuse that happens in these camps is not actually new. There have been reports that have been done by local NGOs in Malaysia that have documented what goes on in these camps. There was a report that came out in 1996. But of course, the way the Malaysian government reacted to it was to say, this is malicious defamation. And the group that actually came out with the report was charged. The trial is still going on right now. And the conditions of these camps were never actually opened up for independent scrutiny.
Saskia Sassen, as you listen to these descriptions, the stories that we have heard so far, we're going to be moving on to another segment where we talk about workers here at home and the unsafe conditions that they face. You have written the book Guests and Aliens. You've long looked at migration flows. What are your overall assessments right now, and particularly since September 11th?
Right. Well, I think that what Lilian just described is happening in many countries around the world. But let me bring in a more general perspective. And I would say that the landscape for organizing has changed. It's become far more complex. It involves immigrant workers. It involves human rights issues. I think it used to be that organizing was something, I mean, there was always death involved and high risk, but there was a clarity about the purpose, the objective, and whom you were organizing that now is lost. Today, as corporations move around the world, as they have various affiliates and factories all over the place, they intersect with many different histories. And that means that organizing labor today, yes, it's partly what the janitors for social justice are doing. Yes, it's partly what is happening here in the United States. But it is also a whole variety of dynamics, struggles, and forms of suffering, such as Lilian just described, and which are not part of the old history of organizing. So I do think that when I think about what it means to organize labor today, what labor struggles mean today, it's a much thicker and more difficult struggle because it will intersect with human rights struggles, it will intersect with migration issues, and now we have September 11, which is yet another series of dynamics that get trotted in and in whose name all kinds of abuses are happening. We know that in the United States, you know, the legislature has passed 11 new legislative items that confine the rights not just of immigrants who are legally here, but also of citizens. So when I think about organizing labor today, I think about something that is the eye, if you want, of the, what is it, the hurricane, right? It is surrounded by an incredibly complex set of dynamics. And in that sense, I think it becomes a crucial issue. It's sort of a struggle of titans, if you want. And it's not just workers as we used to think of it.
Saskia Sassen is a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. You wrote a piece on September 12th, the day after September 11th, the attacks last year, in the London Guardian, in the Guardian newspaper. And you came under severe criticism for your piece. Can you talk about the main point and why people were attacking you?
Well, first let me say that I also got an enormous amount of support from many, many countries in the world. But I got, you know, I got a variety of criticisms, including death threats, etc., from the United States. I think what happened to me, I was here, I saw it happen, and it just struck me that the horror itself, the absolute unexpected quality of the event that September 11th was, should have been an invitation for the United States power. I don't mean the people, I mean power, to ask a few questions. Where do we fit in the world? What is happening? What are we missing that is out there? And the CIA, of course, is notorious for missing stuff. They missed the fall of the Soviet Union. They're continuously missing stuff. And I was horrified. I listened mostly to radio September 11th at what I saw as yet another closing of the American mind. So I basically made a very broad argument saying that part of the landscape of violence is one that involves questions of poverty and abuse of immigrants, illegal trafficking of people, etc. This does not cause terrorism, but it does create rage, hopelessness, and that should be part of how the United States, if you want, situated the issue of September 11th. Well, a lot of people, of course, in the United States especially, thought that really one could only talk about the suffering of the people in this horrible attack. And on some level, psychologically, I understand that. But I will say that in many parts of the world, and I travel an awful amount, too much, people were saying, well, you know, we have been suffering. We have had more death than that. We have, and it's not been noticed, it seems, by the United States. The world has not entered a totally new phase because of the 3,000 dead in the World Trade Center. Now, I'm, you know, this is a horrible event, and something has changed, which is the United States' position towards its own people, actually. And I think that some of the issues that you described earlier about the Coast Guard, these new commissioned forces, is an indication of that. But the truth of the matter is that the world, so many places in the world, have had such a vast amount of suffering. And I wanted to bring that into the examination. I wanted to bring a broader picture of suffering and death and horrible, horrible things happening. So that September 11th was one of multiple such sites. And that clearly was not acceptable, even to some of my very good friends. And I can understand that, by the way. And people think it took a lot of courage for me to write that and to hold that position, because the easier position was a different one. But to me, that was like it was just one other voice that needed to be heard.
Well, Saskia Sassen, author of Guests and Aliens, professor of sociology at University of Chicago, thank you very much. And Lilian Fan of Amnesty International, recently returned from Malaysia. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back on this Labor Day special, we're going to look at labor here at home. We're going to look at the jobs that people have and why the U.S. government is continuing to award hundreds of millions of dollars worth of contracts to corporations that are known to abuse their workers. Stay with us.
I'll sing of Joseph Hillstrom, better known as Old Joe Hill. Murdered by a firing squad, shot but never killed. His will said that his ashes be strewn across the land, so flowers that refuse to die will rise up strong and stand. We sing his songs to fan the flames and talk about him much. The ashes of this rebel voice are still too hot to touch. Joe's corpse lay in Chicago, where 30,000 marched. They flew the wobbly banner high above the throng it arched. The workers sang and cheered his name, they did not eulogize. They honored Joe Hill's last request, don't mourn, organize. And the union took Joe's body, which then they did cremate. His ashes stuffed in envelopes and mailed.
Joe Hill's ashes. Mark Levy here on Resistance Radio, Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly a century ago, Upton Sinclair published The Jungle, a muckraking expose of the meat industry that brought to light many of the great dangers Americans face on the job. A century later, workplace safety remains a key issue for labor unions, the charge the federal government has failed to set proper standards. Last week, the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Doug Daugherty, told reporters workers depending on voluntary guidelines developed by the big corporations for workplace safety protections is like depending on an Enron 401k plan for your retirement security. Nobody gets hurt in the boardroom, but workers lose everything. Workers can indeed lose everything, including their lives. An estimated 165 people across the country die every day from illnesses related to their jobs. Another 18 die from work-related injuries. And the government has not only failed to enforce its own standards, but also awarded billions of dollars in contracts to many of the very corporations that have among the worst worker safety records. According to a recent investigative report by Ken Silverstein in Mother Jones magazine, over 50 of the nation's largest contractors were cited for close to 1,400 workplace safety violations. Each violation posed a risk of death or serious physical harm to workers. Ford Motor Company racked up almost 300 serious OSHA violations between 1995 and 2000, but the government still awarded them $442 million in federal business in those years. Today on Labor Day, we'll look at workplace safety and examine what the U.S. government is doing to protect or endanger workers. Ken Silverstein is our first guest in the segment. Can you talk about your piece, Unjust Rewards, and what corporations have been rewarded and why the U.S. government is still giving millions of dollars to these companies that hurt their workers?
Well, we just decided to look at some of the biggest contractors, some of the biggest federal contractors, because it's a huge, huge pot of money. You're talking about, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion a year. And we wanted to see if contractors were behaving responsibly. We didn't just check OSHA violations. We also checked EPA violations and other issues like committing fraud in their, you know, some companies who actually committed fraud. They cheated the federal government on their contracts, and they kept getting money, too. But the OSHA violations were among the most disturbing because you have cases where companies, their workers have been killed due to negligence, and yet they, you know, may have paid a relatively small fine, especially if you compare it to their federal contracts. And they kept getting more and more federal money. There was never anything done to review these companies or to cut them off from getting the federal dollars. So there, you know, I looked at one company, TRW, which is a big defense manufacturer, but it's also one of the nation's leading manufacturers of airbags. And they had a plant out in Arizona where you had an incredible number of environmental violations. Last year, the company paid $24 million in civil and criminal penalties for illegally dumping chemicals in three states. And at the same plants, you had a number of worker deaths. You had all sorts of injuries. You had this incredible record of workplace safety violations. And yet TRW was the ninth biggest contractor. Last year, they received about $10 billion worth in federal contracts. They paid about $5.7 million in fines. But, you know, when you look at $5.7 million, you might initially go, oh, that's quite a bit. But if you're getting $10 billion in federal contracts, it doesn't seem like much at all. So that was one of the real striking cases. There was also Phillips Petroleum. They've got a plant in Pasadena, Texas, and there's just been all sorts of problems there. In 1989, there was a big explosion. 23 workers were killed. 1999 and in 2000, there were two more explosions. That three workers were killed and 73 more were injured. Phillips was hit with $2.3 million in fines for ignoring safety hazards. Yet it continued to receive tens of millions of dollars in federal contracts. So this is the sort of thing that we found time and time again, that many of the nation's largest contractors have violated workplace safety, environmental laws. They've cheated the government on their federal contracts, and nothing is done to cut them off.
You talk about the contractor responsibility rule, which was revoked by President Bush, that required officials to review a company's recent history of violating federal laws before awarding them federal contracts. So the U.S. government is knowingly giving these companies millions of dollars. Yes, they're being fined, record amounts of money, but as you said, it's worth it to them because they're getting much more.
Well, they're certainly, you know, I think that the fines are a drop in the bucket next to the federal contracts. You mentioned the President Clinton, his administration did issue a rule that would have tightened up the regulations. And there's a rule on the books right now that says companies that don't practice acceptable business ethics are not supposed to get federal contracts. But the rule is so vaguely worded and so hard to interpret that it's just never applied. The only case I could find, now Enron and Arthur Andersen were both recently suspended because I suspect that had something to do with the scope of that scandal being so immense that it would have been really embarrassing to be giving out federal contracts to those companies. But other than those two firms, the only company I found, the only federal contractor I found that had been cut off was Mitsubishi, which was cut off about 10 or 15 years ago because, and it had nothing to do with violating workplace or environmental law. It had to do with the fact that they were dumping their products into the U.S. market. And so Congress suspended Mitsubishi from receiving federal contracts. The Clinton administration did issue a rule that would have tightened this up. I mean, they set out specific criteria that contracting officers were supposed to look at. It took a number of steps to make it more likely, anyway, that a company that consistently and egregiously violated the law would have been cut off from federal contracting. But that it took the Clinton administration 2 years to develop that rule. Clinton actually issued it on his way out. It was actually in December after Gore had lost the election to Bush, and you know, about a month before Clinton actually stepped down. And you know, some might impute a certain amount of cynicism to this. But in any event, the rule was passed. Bush suspended it almost immediately after taking office and promised to review it. And then right before Christmas, killed it very, very quietly. I mean, it was done, I think it was done on the December 24th or December 25th. And I apologize, I've got a copy of my article here, and I can't find that specific.
Quite a gift to America's workers, quite a Christmas gift.
Yeah, exactly, and it was done clearly because, you know, reporters are on holiday, nobody's paying a whole lot of attention, and so they sort of slipped this one, you know, they sort of slipped this revocation of the rule in there.
Well, Ken Silverstein, we're also joined by Lisa Cullen, who wrote the book A Job to Die For, Why So Many Americans Are Killed, Injured, or Made Ill at Work, and What to Do About It. Lisa Cullen, in your book, you point out that every day, 165 Americans die from occupational disease. 165 Americans die every day.
Correct.
From occupational. What do you mean by occupational diseases?
Occupational cancers, illnesses resulting from exposures on the job, reproductive effects, birth defects, liver failure, kidney failure, any number of health diseases that we are familiar with that may have been caused by a person's job.
What can be done about this?
Well, I'm interested in Ken's article because most of the data, the occupational injury and illness data, companies hold that information very close and tight-chested with that information, and it's very hard to get an accurate picture of where the illnesses and health effects are coming from in order to target prevention efforts. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to notify the public of just the enormity of the problem, because occupational health surveillance has got to be greatly improved in order to start taking steps.
interested today on the front page of the New York Times headline, laid off workers swelling the cost of disability pay, most from low-end jobs. Number rose by 2.4 million in a decade, pushing price to $60 billion last year. It's put in terms of what it's costing the U.S. government.
That's typical. There's a lot of press, really, on increases that employees cost, so-called, to the systems, but there's very little attention given to the overall cost of the system. What were the injuries and illnesses to begin with? What happened before the employee was let go? Sometimes employees have injuries and illnesses that they're suffering with and just taking Advil or going to a doctor on their own, paying with their private insurance, and then when they're let go of their job, they realize if it gets worse that they will have to pay for it, so then they file a claim. Most workers don't want to go file injury and illness claims. They don't pay very well, so as long as they can suffer along, many do that. And so there is usually a swelling of claims after people are let go or if they fear they're going to be let go, because many suffer with it beforehand.
What made you write this book?
Well, I basically wanted to educate the public about what I see as an unknown epidemic that's occurring in our workplaces. It's known to folks in OSHA, the folks in industry that work to protect their workers from health and safety hazards, but it seems to be generally unknown by the public, this huge number of occupational illnesses and deaths that occur. And I also wrote it because I think that we can do a lot to prevent them. We have great advances in technology. We know so much more about chemicals and the body and how we can monitor exposures and control exposures that I just think we should and can do so much more.
And yet, Ken Silverstein, the U.S. government is rewarding corporations with these high death rate or occupational disease rates.
Yeah, there's been no change at all, since the Clinton administration issued the rule and it was subsequently revoked. It's clear that no action is going to be taken. In fact, I talked to people who had been proponents of tightening up the rule, and they pretty much said that there's not really anything we can do at this point, because all the years that went into drafting and crafting and putting together a new rule that Clinton finally issued at the very end of his administration is now dead. There's just nothing that can be done, at least until the new administration takes office.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Lisa Cullen's book, A Job to Die For, is published by Common Courage Press. It is hot off the press. And Ken Silverstein's piece, Unjust Rewards, appeared in Mother Jones magazine just a couple of months ago. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, with help from Alex Wolf, Monica Lopez, and Sand Hung. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, sitting in for Anthony Sloan, who is still recovering. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. We are broadcasting live for the first time around the country on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and of course broadcasting on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!